Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, where we explore the cultures of consciousness. There was a moment early on in my reading of the book by today's guest, the book being Present Shock, the author being Douglas Rushkoff, where I knew I was going to be in for a good ride. And the moment was a simple one. He was talking about the feeling of frozenness that you get when in the midst of getting rid of a plastic bottle, like a plastic bottle of water. And I find myself sometimes just clutching the plastic bottle because I'm thirsty and there's no other water and I need to hydrate. And then I'm sitting there and I have this grok with the plastic bottle, and it's linked to the, you know, the Texas-sized typhoon of nastiness swirling in the Pacific, and I sort of sense the broken-down pieces of plastic that are entering into the bodies of seabirds, and the impossibility, in some sense, of getting myself out of the situation. Yes, I carry a metal bottle around, and I try to fill it up, blah, 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 but I forget, and there I am once again in that moment. But it's not so much about the problem of the environment and the way that we're all tied in. That's an aspect of it, but really it's the sense of time, the sense of frozenness, that this one incredibly trivial gesture is somehow linked and reverberating and sort of constrained by my knowledge of the situation. And it's a wonderful example of what makes this book a pretty special one. Doug Rushkoff's written a lot of interesting books, and I'm sure many of our listeners have checked them out. But Life Inc. was terrific a couple years ago, and you know, stretching back to his early works on media theory and cyberdelic culture. But this one I particularly like because it combines a lot of rich analysis of our moment with a big picture, a willingness to create some neologisms and ideas to sort of organize what's going on. But there's also a very strong sense of our own individual existential experience of this exploding, claustrophobic, fascinating, overwhelming moment that we're in, largely mediated through technology, but not just about technology, also about the ways in which our media environments are allowing us to see different aspects of how the world works, but also cutting off familiar ways of organizing that stuff, but not just conceptually, really in terms of time, of how we actually experience time, how time is bound into our days, into our decisions, into the operations we undertake. And it's really a fundamental mystery. And the one sort of concept I want to throw out there that I've been thinking a lot and in some ways practicing with in my own life, both cognitively as I try to understand the world and the decisions I make, but also existentially as I move through the day, is this contrast that I was really happy to see that Doug also talks about, which is between two kinds of time, two ideas of time, chronos and kairos, two Greek words. And the basic idea is that chronos is the clock time. Chronos is the time that we can measure that's objective, that's sort of like the underlying idea of a regular pulse that can organize all of the phenomena and all of the flow that's going on in the world, in our lives, et cetera, et cetera. This is sort of, it's almost like a kind of gold standard of time, that no matter how you feel like time is stretching out, going too quickly, the move, you know, the time frame of a fly versus the time frame of a glacier, that they can all be related to this one series of beats that is incarnated in our technologies, in our clocks, in little quartz vibrations, et cetera, et cetera. But there's another kind of time, or maybe many kinds of time. But one way of entering into them is this idea of kairos, which is qualitative time. And it's not just that, you know, individually, regardless of whatever the clock's telling me, I might feel one day like there's a long, slow, you know, lazy afternoon, and another day that I'm running around like the proverbial chicken with its head cut off. But it's actually that time itself has qualities that spill over, cut against, tangle, and amplify chronos. And that we err in not paying enough attention to these shifts in kairos by simply thinking, oh yes, well, time after all is just a series of regular objective beats, the time of chronos. But this is just sort of an abstract way to set up what's also a very rich conversation about moving through the world today and what it feels like with media. I can't wait to get into this conversation. But before we bring Doug on, we have our co-host here, Maja Daou, the White Witch of Los Angeles. Hi, Maja.
Hi. How are you, Eric?
Good. I'm kind of curious. I know you're an astrologer. We talk about astrology sometime on the show. In fact, we got to get like a good astrologer on the show sometime. We haven't really.
Ooh, yeah.
Because you're so, you know, it's like you're the home team. Maybe Rick Barnett. He could be good. But I'm wondering whether how being deep within this, you know, ancient, esoteric way of understanding time, in some sense, has an impact on the way you experience daily time, you know.
Oh man, 100,000,000,000,000%. It's interesting, like you were saying, the difference between chronos and kairos. To me, I see chronos as like those kind of like you said, the clock ticks, the way that we kind of see time progressing, or that, you know, inevitable and unstoppable progression of time. But to me, the kairos aspect is, how is that integrated into everything else? I really feel like doing astrology and divination has exposed me to see how time is related to space and physical matter, like physical material, like the planets or like our bodies, and that time has, you know, consequences or influence or, you know, effects on physical material, where a lot of people like to abstract it and think that, like, you know, there's just some kind of thing that's time out there and it kind of goes and we go with it. But if you can exist in a moment of it and participate with time instead of just kind of like hanging out floating down the time river, right, then you can start to like use the divination, use the kairotic time in a way like a magician would, by being conscious of it.
Wow, that's so great, because it's just totally like, you know, resonating with some of the really fascinating discussions in Rushkoff's book. So welcome to the show, Doug.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. It's been too long.
Do I sound okay? I'm using weird microphones and things.
That sounds all right, you know.
All right.
I think we're all sort of used to, like, voices moving through all sorts of different filters at this point. There's hardly even a reference for an authentically sounding voice these days. You know, I had this sort of, like, general plan to leap into the questions with you on Present Shock, which I really, really quite enjoy, just finished this morning. But in a way, Maja's question brought up a more specific part of your book, which I thought was one of the more intriguing, which is where you were talking about this sort of, you were talking about different kinds of time, and particularly the different kinds of time that we have in our bodies, as our bodies link into environmental forces, to cycles of the moon, to these, without invoking any kind of astrological forces, but just the kind of ways in which we are already these time-binding creatures, and that this aspect of ourselves is running up against pretty hard challenges because of the way in which we've sort of agreed to turn ourselves over to technological time, to digital time, to the time of the media networks and the pulsations of bits flying about. And I thought that was a pretty good way into some of these both political and social, but also biological and existential aspects of time that you're really bringing to the fore. So I thought we might just dive in right there.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the what you're talking about, I mean, as I see it, is a really ancient battle, if you want to frame it that way, or certainly an ancient trade-off between Chronos and Kairos. I mean, I found the easiest way to explain to people what Chronos and Kairos are is like Chronos, you know, is the time on the clock. Like I crashed the car at 4:01. You know, Kairos is what's the best time to tell Dad you crashed the car? You know, 4:31. No, it's after he's had his drink and before he's opened his bills, right? Kairos is timing, right? It's timing is and it's particularly human or natural. Kairos is readiness and appropriateness of time for one thing or another. There's kind of a judgment and a rightness and there's an organic quality to it. You know, where Chronos sees all moments as the same, Kairos sees all moments as uniquely qualified for different things. And if you look historically, you know, the history of media or technology can be looked at, you know, different ways of representing Chronos and then various, you know, reactions of Kairos to that. So, you know, back in pre-biblical days, you had people, you know, looking at the sun and the moon, and their sense of time was, you know, very cyclical, based either on the harvest or on the moon cycle or the daily sun cycle or the seasonal cycle. You know, and then you know, you get, you know, God bless them, you get the ancient Jews starting to write things down, and with text came history. You know, with text came the first real Chronos. That even before we had sundials and the ability to kind of break up the day, we had text, which gave us an ability to be accountable over time. We wrote contracts, but we ended up with sort of monotheism and the ability for a messianic age to come at some point in the future. We got laws that we were going to develop in an ongoing way, and we got the notion of progress. You know, so with that came, of course, the repression of all sorts of values, all sorts of kind of, I guess you can call them pagan, although they were pre-pagan values and the sort of Canaanite values that were much more, you know, chaotic, if you will.
It was actually totally Canaanite, because if you do a lot of the research, they'll put like our kind of modern version of astrology to the Canaans and how they like kind of put that together and like that kind of, obviously it's ancient and goes back way, way far, but it's exactly Canaanite. So it's funny you would use that word.
Right. Right. I mean, and then, you know, after that, we get the industrial age and the invention of the real clock. And with that came the whole idea of kind of time is money. People, rather than working for one another and trading things in some kind of Burning Man medieval peer-to-peer bazaar, now you have people working on the clock, working for an hour or 2 hours. We were, you know, getting wages for our time. The money we invented in the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance was basically money with a clock in it. It's money that's loaned out from a central treasury at interest that has to be paid back in time. And that set the time as money clock in motion, where we had an economy that needed to expand through colonialism, always driving forward. And these notions of progress and growth became really embedded in who we are. And now that we get digital time, there's another kind of Chronos, this very pulsing notion of Chronos, you know, where time to an industrial age clock, to an analog clock, is some segment of a day. You know, an hour is a 12th of a day or 24th of a day cycle. An hour or a minute in digital time, if you think of a digital clock, it's a pulse. It's a pure duration. It doesn't have to be based in anything else. The clock just does something that is a second. You know, it doesn't have to be a second, doesn't have to be a 60th of anything. It's just a second. You know, so it's yet another newly very, you know, highly generic notion of each moment in time as a decision point, as a potential choice, as the stage in a program, as a moment in a sequence. And humans, meanwhile, all along, you know, have been living in this other kind of time, you know, this thing that we're calling Kairos. And, you know, what I've been trying to do, and this gets people worried that I'm turning weird or esoteric, but it's actually scientific and quite normal. If anything, this should be the normal and the other should be the weird. I'm just trying to stay aware of when is it day, when is it night, what season in it, what phase of the moon are we in? You know, and as I do research into biological clocks, you know, we find out that there's thousands of biological clocks affecting, you know, us and everything around us. And people, it turns out, are on a very lunar cycle. You know, the ancient Jews knew this. The original lunar Jewish calendar before Hillel had to, you know, compromise with the Romans to make it compatible with the annual calendar. Even they got this, is that in the first week of a new moon, there tends to be a rush of acetylcholine. And the second week of a moon, there's an emphasis on serotonin. Then another week is an emphasis on dopamine. And the last week's an emphasis on norepinephrine. So if you know that you and everybody around you is in dopamine week, that's not the week to get work done, right? That's the week to party. If everybody's in serotonin week, maybe you'll get something done. If everyone's in acetylcholine week, that's when you introduce new ideas. So, you know, by following these kinds of or at least being aware of these kinds of trends, you end up moving into Kairos and you're able to use it. And that's where my hope is, that digital technology, because it's programmable, we can now begin to conform the machine to us. We can conform digital rhythms and even the rhythms of capitalism to the rhythms of humans, rather than constantly trying to reconfigure humans to conform to the technology.
Yeah, it's one of the ways that I walked away from this idea in your book was realizing that the idea we have in our head that there's only one kind of time gets bound up with the kind of time that's reproduced by our most in-your-face machine. So when the clock was dominant and it moved out of regulating monks' lives into regulating industrial capital, then the clock became kind of, that was that one kind of time that organizes everything else. Mm-hmm. But in order to understand what's going on with our bodies, and also very much in terms of things that are going on with natural cycles, where you have to start to recognize that there are these very long, slow-moving things that cannot be changed in a moment. You know, you can't change the carbon cycle by sending a tweet. And that to think that everything is reducible to this one kind of time, we distort the reality that we are binding multiple kinds of time all the time, and that to reduce it to that insistent digital pulse is not only, you know, harmful, but it's just not even sort of accurate or appropriate to the situation. And it was funny because in that chapter where you brought up the stuff, you know, a lot of the chapters in the book, not all of them, have a similar structure where you begin as kind of a social critic, where you talk about the deleterious effects that, or at least the very challenging effects that our current media environment are creating in our lives, how they're undermining more familiar ways of organizing time and narrative. And then you offer some suggestions, some ways out. And I was totally thinking you were going to go into sort of not a Luddite, but a sort of, you know, media fast, you know, get away, get back into the earth, get back, you know, gardening, you know, that kind of move, which a lot of people are doing for very good reasons, because they need to, you know, open up to different kinds of time, to different kinds of practices away from the computer. But then you started talking about chronobiology, or these sort of the biology of time that we carry within us, and the way it links to the lunar cycles. And then I had a question, and this is this interesting question for you that's sort of about how you see your role and your the kinds of information and the kinds of concepts you're doing in this and in your other books, where it's like the idea that we can become more attuned with our natural rhythms, with the ways in which our bodies are in environments, that there are linkages to the moon, that it affects our neurotransmitters, and that we can therefore modify our expectations and to some degree our work based on these in order to be more efficient, more productive, happier, more balanced and more generative, less at odds with this kind of crazy world that we're living in. That's really great on some level. And on another level, I'm like, but isn't this just more of the same? Like, let's say I'm a manager of a company where I'm tracking all of my employees through all of their work breaks or whatever. And I go, wait, you know, if I can sync my expectations of how long all of these drones are on their phones to the moon, I'm going to get more work out of them. And I'm saying this not to undermine the value of these ideas. I think they're really important and very necessary and really helpful. But it made me think about there's a way in which your work is like hardcore social criticism, and there's also a way in which it's almost like a kind of survival guide, like, hey guys, maybe this is pretty bad, but we got to work with what we have. And it's an interesting line that you walked. Does that make sense? I mean,
the difference is, there's a lot of different ways I can answer that because there's so many different points you raised. But I mean, just to the idea of someone trying to manage employees, if I had someone who was managing me, if I were an employee, and someone is managing me in a sense in a way that's consonant with my rhythms rather than trying to defeat my rhythms, then I'm not going to need Prozac. I'm not going to need Adderall. I'm not going to need a psychotherapist because he's going to understand that there's this week when I really do want to work and get stuff done. And there's this other week when I want to just be exposed to new ideas. There's another week when I'm going to want to work structurally. That's not a bad thing. It's what I did with myself. You know, I get stressed out when I'm trying to get myself to write during a dopamine week, you know, when I've got to get this thing done because I have a deadline because I'm working for an industrial age company that doesn't, you know, live to my rhythms. But once, you know, when I started with this book, once I started realizing, oh, this is the week I'm going to have new ideas. This is the week I'm going to write them down. This is the week I'm going to party. This is the week I'm going to do my structural work and my sort of what goes in what chapter stuff. My productivity went way, way up. You know, that's never a bad thing because not only did my productivity go up, but my Slack quotient went up, right? That was what I originally thought, many of us thought, was going to be the beauty of digital technology to begin with. We're going to get off the friggin' industrial age clock and get to work at home in our own time in our underwear, right? And it's not going to matter when I've done this. I don't have to be at some, you know, fluorescent lit awful building for 8 hours a day. I'm just going to produce the stuff. You know, that's what the industrial age was about disconnecting us from, right? We got disconnected from the value we created and we got put on the clock instead, right? Where everything was the same. So I don't see production as the enemy doing stuff. I don't see efficiency as the problem. I mean, I see human suffering is the problem, you know, or the dehumanization of everything. So it's not a matter of making the workplace the enemy. If there's an enemy, it's, you know, really, it's kind of, you know, Wired magazine and the culture that they represented in the early 1990s when they took the digital revolution and everything that it could have been or should have been, for my money, and turned it into a kind of a poster child for the NASDAQ stock exchange and as a way of extending and amplifying the values of the industrial age long past their welcome.
Right. So how well were you able to really chart and modify your own writing habits vis-a-vis this model of the lunar cycles?
Oh, a whole lot. You know, and I had gotten there where, you know, first week of the new moon, acetylcholine is when I'm going to talk to other people about the ideas. It's when I'm going to read ideas because acetylcholine, you're kind of the most peppy and you're the most kind of open to stuff like that. It's my ego is kind of out of the way in an acetylcholine week. And I'm, you know, kind of open to the way other people are thinking. In serotonin week, I just shut everything down and went into work mode. You know, that was just when, and I didn't have to force myself. When I knew it was serotonin week, it's just like, it just comes. And I get so many, it's like, I'm going to time my day. So I'm not answering emails. So I'm not doing these interviews and always on kind of things, but I'm actually just in there working. Man, I wrote so much, you know, and sometimes I would push it one day or so into dopamine week, you know, just to try to get that last squeeze that last bit of serotonin out, then dopamine week, I'm going to play with my kid. That's when we're going to go to Legoland. That's where I'm going to, you know, party in whatever way that I do. That's when I'm going to get involved in sort of experiential, if slightly self-destructive behaviors. And then finally, after I'm recovering from that norepinephrine week, when I looked at my chapters, when I reorganized my website, when I did my calendar, my schedule, and all the kind of systems like Obama-like, cool, structural thinking. And it was massive. I mean, I felt different, right? I felt so much more in sync, so much happier. And my word count went up by about 40%, even though I was only really writing a week and a half out of the month, which was just insane. Now that I'm in kind of whatever this is, tour mode, you know, the book comes out and I am always on, right? I'm not sleeping regular hours. I'm doing interviews for whatever, you know, for Australia at midnight. And also looking at, you know, they're sending me a sales report. So I'm looking at numbers and my activities and metrics and all. I'm totally out of it now. I'm no longer experiencing myself as coherent, but rather as, I mean, I'm functional, right? I can push through. I can drink coffee, but I'm incoherent.
Well, and so let me ask you this then, because this has to do with consciously interacting with those times and becoming like aware of these things and using it to your best advantage, which is like what we do with the astrology reports, to tell people when is it the best time for you to do this, blah, blah, blah. So do you feel like, because those are the natural rhythms and we're driven by the moon, like what if we have to do something like at the wrong time, right? What if we just are required by whatever forces to have an action present in the dopamine time, which would be more ideal at another time? Like, how do you feel like there is a way for a human being to kind of like work outside of time in those biological ways, or do you feel like we are just kind of like trapped into them?
You know, it depends. I mean, we live in a society that was reconfigured over 500 years to prevent people from engaging powerfully and collectively with the world, right? With anything.
Right.
So it's going to take some time until we can unwind that, right? If you work for Walmart, they're not going to care about your lunar cycles, right? But if you're working on Etsy, it is. So, you know, as we unwind as these companies either collapse in their own weight, or we gain the ability as part of a kind of a maker peer-to-peer society that, you know, is attending to one another's needs directly rather than through these giant extractive corporations and institutions, we're going to be able to slowly return to it. But, I mean, for now, no. I mean, you can't do it all at once. You got to, you know, you got to feed the colonel's cat, as my dad used to say. And that does mean living in their time. But you live in their time, you live in the fake time, and you slowly try to readjust, or at least you're aware. Okay, this is an acetylcholine week, and I have to get up at 6 a.m. I still have to do my shift labor. I still have to do this. But I'm going to emphasize this. I'm going to try to be more social. I'm going to understand that there might be more opportunities here to meet more people. And then, you know, serotonin week, I'm going to know this. And norepinephrine week, I'm not going to worry that people are acting paranoid because that's sort of what they do. Or I'm going to look at my dreams and my dream journal over these weeks and say, oh, this is why they keep shifting from this to that to this to that. You know, I'm going to, you know, there's different places that you can bring different things into awareness, whether it's scheduling a party or scheduling when you're going to try to do, you know, if you're going to be having a 9-to-5 job but also trying to write a book, you know which, now you know which week of the month you can be working nights also, you know, to try to get your writing done, and which weeks you're not going to try to do that. And so it's simple and slow, but yeah, just becoming aware of it is half the battle, you know. Just, you know, and even if you don't want to learn what's what, just if you become aware of what cycle of the moon you're in, if you just check out the moon each night, where it is, your body will kind of take care of the rest, because you've got like 500,000 years of evolutionary learning in there. So it's
what I love about this model too is that
you know, we could have a scientific discussion about it, about the research and how this works and why that would be the case, and that's good stuff. But the other thing about it is the way it functions as a story, or at least a template, a way of having a model of the variation of time, of these qualitative differences. So rather than just thinking of it's just one damn week after another, instead there's this kind of flow, this sort of analog wave that we are riding, and simply by allowing that, and this is where the question of the, you know, the more esoteric questions of astrology come in too, is that regardless of what's actually happening, is there actually a mechanism? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that something happens when you allow qualitative templates, correspondences, a sense of organic flow to enter into your everyday story, that things happen just for that reason. And in a way, it responds to, you know, one of the great themes of your book as well that we haven't really touched on very much, is how our current moment, with its intense focus on the present, with its intense sort of reactive, constantly on the fly, constantly refocusing, reframing, you know, responding to new opportunities, et cetera, that it really does a number on our sense of narrative, on the ways in which long narratives with beginnings, middles, and ends, whether we see them in cultural artifacts or in the stories of our lives or our religious values, that all of those things are very, very under the gun and fragmenting and fracturing, and that without some way of responding to that, that's not just submitting to this mania of the presentism, of the technologically mediated hyper-present, it's really tough. And so the kinds of things you're talking about here aren't just sensible, but in terms of the science, but they're also, they allow us to start to reclaim our own rhythms and to allow our minds, imaginations to tell stories or to create different kinds of maps of those things that seem, you know, clearly very, 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 very helpful.
Right. Well, we're moving from a kind of a narrative-based beginning, middle, and end, you know, story culture, the kind of culture that's really dominated since Aristotle identified the narrative arc in Greek tragedy, you know, to this one that on the one hand is very broken up, right? It's this very kind of individualized video game-like choice-to-choice real-time kind of post-narrative thing, but is it at the same time is also a potentially very patient and new kind of narrative, whether it's, you know, the Occupy movement moving slowly but surely towards kind of undefined goals in some ways, but very defined if you don't think of them as things in the future, but you think of them as kind of a new normative behavior. Or instead of trying to figure out where is this all going, where is it all going, what's going to happen, instead kind of just learning to recognize patterns, which goes back to this non-generic notion of time, non-generic notion of reality, that not, you know, it's not a matter of saying this is that and drawing congruences between things, but recognizing, oh, this is kind of like that, is kind of like that. These sorts of things seem to be happening right now. What does that sort of mean to me? And being okay with it a little bit fuzzy. That just because it's fuzzy doesn't mean it's not true, right? It's just not quite literal, right? And literal is very specific, right? It's not, it can be written down and replicated. No, but it's still, it's nonetheless real. I mean, this is what Terence McKenna was kind of working towards with Time Wave Zero, and it's interesting that he saw it as completely consonant with computers and fractals. You know, what are fractals but these self-similar shapes? They're ways of trying to take feedback loops and draw some conclusions from them or find the texture of them. And where Terence McKenna got in trouble was when he took that pattern recognition tool of Time Wave Zero and try to overlay it on the calendar and say, this part is here and that part is there. You know, so rather than a shape that we use to intuit sort of where things are going and how they are on a human level, he kind of tried to lock down. He tried to sort of, really what he tried to do was align Kairos and Kronos on the same map.
Exactly, with that kind of eschatological sensibility recurring almost against his own, I mean, to some degree against his own, tendencies. It's like if there's, a non-eschatological book, it's the I Ching. I mean, the I Ching does not go, okay, we're all going to, it's all going to end on this, like, one final point. It's the opposite. It's deeply cyclical. So to go into the I Ching and then try to extract a historical eschaton from it. It's brilliant. It's fast. It's wonderful science fiction. It's very productive in some ways. It inspires a lot. It actually works as kind of a myth, but it definitely distorted, I think, some of that view. But we have to take a break right now. We're talking to Doug Rushkoff about Present Shock here on Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and today we are speaking with Douglas Rushkoff about Present Shock. And before the break, Eric had mentioned, the I Ching and how it does a really good job of going into those cycles and looking at things from that bigger perspective. And, I'm curious if for you find a relationship. So let's say we come into, an accordance with our lunar cycle and with those bigger kind of cycles of time, the big wheels that keep on turning. And if we do that, how would that affect, like, minutes of the day, like on a daily level? Like, so do those bigger, like, kind of accordances, do those, like, kind of spiral down in a kind of fractal way into the smaller moments? Like Eric had mentioned at the beginning of the show, of having that teeny tiny second with the plastic bottle. I mean, maybe you could give us an example of how, when we start coming into accord with that, then every teeny tiny minute or moment becomes a kind of reflection of that bigger pattern.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that this four-phase map of time really does apply to a whole lot of other things. I mean, as you start looking at various systems of thought from, Rudolf Steiner to Willem Reich to even the weird ones that I don't like, all these folks, Irving Darduk and the superwave theory, they all kind of break down into these four moments or four ways of approaching the world. So, there are these four phases of the moon, but they also correspond kind of four personality types that, each of us tends to fall into one of these profiles. This the four phases of breath, from impulse to inhale to sustain to exhale. If you are with a person for, two full breaths, really, for four phases of breath, that's all you need to really connect with them on a level that allows you to develop rapport, which is literally just breathing with somebody. I see it, between the four seasons and the four phases and everything else. It really does work, so that you can say that over the course of an hour, there's going to be this sort of acetylcholine part, there's going to be this serotonin part, there's going to be a dopamine part, then there's going to be that norepinephrine part. Every rave that you go to follows that same sort of four cycles. Aristotle was trying to understand those, and he interpreted it in the sort of the male orgasm curve, but that was a very specific four-part wave he was looking at, one that's going to entrain an audience into a cathartic, a highly cathartic moment, or how do you maximize catharsis? And really, he's not looking at maximizing the other parts of that cycle, or he's not optimizing for that. So yeah, I see it all over the place, and it really helps. It helps because time is the easiest one for me. It's just, you know, to everything there's a season, right? If you can really go with that, then you stop trying to nail things down in specific times, and you start to see it all as change. We're always moving from one state to another state to another state. And, you know, and I feel like we're on the brink of that. If we apply digital in that way, if we return to production, return to ourselves as sort of as the source of agency and autonomy in this, then we have a chance of actually restoring or retrieving a lot of what we've repressed in the last two kind of cultural renaissances. If we just program this stuff to seduce us into, you know, states of whatever you want to call it, digital intoxication, then the corporations win and humanity just sort of goes away.
Yeah, I mean, and you do a really wonderful job of describing and analyzing that sense of overload and the kind of madness of it. And it's kind of incredible how much we live with it, how many people live with it on a daily basis, the sense of just a kind of, you know, half-controlled insanity. And yet we feel, you know, very bereft often of what to do, how to kind of modify it. And one of the, you know, suggestions you put forward here just in this conversation is this increasing ability to do pattern recognition, that drawing connections, drawing patterns, even the kind of pattern that we're talking about here with the four phases, that's a kind of pattern. It's open-ended. You can make different linkages. You can map different systems onto each other and onto your own life and your own body in different ways. And this gets into this, one of your chapters about fractal noia, which is it's a two-edged sword, this pattern recognition that in some ways comes in to supplant the kind of meaningfulness that we once associated with those old narrative arcs that clearly don't really work the same way anymore, don't really work at all in some ways. So we turn towards pattern recognition as a way to kind of make up for the context that, and drives that narrative provided. But there's this two-edged sword, which you talk about, and what I really want to hear you do is to define the difference in a way between the kind of, you could call it unhealthy pattern recognition that leads to, as you point out, kind of paralyzing conspiracy theories or these kinds of not really saying or doing anything because everything connects to everything else, and you're like, great, well, that doesn't really do very much. You know, your example there was like, if you're friends with everybody on Facebook on the planet, then it doesn't mean anything to be a friend anymore. You know, it's about variation in connection, variation in pattern. And yet at the same time, you are representing and calling for and demonstrating another kind of pattern recognition that's much more, well, we would say organic, healthy, balanced, engaged, self-aware. And I'm curious how you what makes those differences? What turns one style of thinking and processing into fractal noia, to an excess of connections, and what gets us out of this crazy digital chronos into a deeper kind of pattern recognition?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, the dark path or the dark side of the force would be big data, say, which is looking for kind of exact correlations and ways of reducing populations down to kind of predictable units of humanity rather than unpredictable, volatile, organic creatures. You know, and to some extent, it works, right? They can use big data to come up with, what they think are patterns, but are actually just correlations, you know, between, okay, people who like Kevin Spacey also like David Fincher, and they also like political intrigue. So let's create, you know, House of Cards with those people involved in it and develop the plots this way, because our Netflix big data engine has, you know, has determined that there are these congruences. And you end up with, you know, media that feels kind of like cheese doodles, right? It's compelling on a certain level, but it's utterly synthetic and doesn't satisfy on any human level. It just kind of goes through you. And you don't know why, because it's hitting the right neurons or enough of them to, you know, release a little whatever, you know, a little dopamine or something that gets you going, but it's not the real thing, you know, as opposed to something that comes from a human being who's been able to recognize patterns and can share those, which is, you know, something much more like
it's poetry. The removal of the consciousness from the thing, right? It becomes robotic. Like, I mean, if you look at all magic, all the correspondence charts, right? It's all correspondence. Like you said, even down to the minute. Like, this minute is Saturn, this is Venus, this is blah. All the planets, everything has a correspondence, right? So, you know, the magician takes those correspondences, makes the recipe, puts together, like you said, like, well, this person likes this and they like this, so we put them together and we make this. But there has to be a consciousness driving behind it to, like, kind of curate or, you know, like a cook. You can have it the same with anything. Like, if someone's putting together a recipe, one person will do it really well because they'll put their soul in it. And the other person, if they're just, like, throwing it together for McDonald's, there's no feeling in it. I mean, I hate to get all gooey and wishy-washy, but it's like you said, productivity is going to follow when people's natural rhythms are there because their consciousness is triggered and they're aware of what's happening because they're in that second that it's happening. They're in it. They're conscious. They're going. So, I mean, I don't think there's another explanation for it. Like, why else wouldn't it work? Like, what do you, in your opinion, why do you think it's robotic and it doesn't go?
Well, because it's not made by people with reasons, right?
Right.
It's made by, or except for the reason, except to extract money from someone. You know, it's the same as a cheese doodle. It's manufactured to get people to eat and buy it, not to satisfy anything. It's not like someone said, this is going to be this delicious thing. It's like, no, it's manufactured. It's chemically manufactured to make people put more of them in the mouth. You know, that's what it's for. That's not about feeding people. That's not about nourishment. That's not about satisfaction. It's about creating the compulsion, whether it's with MSG or whatever. You know, but the other way that people go off the rails with pattern recognition is when, you know, because we're trying to make sense of the world in the present tense without stories, without cause and effect, it's very easy to get paranoid, right? We're trying to understand the world by kind of looking at a snapshot and drawing connections between things in that picture. And if you have to make sense of things in the present tense with no access to story, with no access to cause and effect, you end up connecting things that aren't genuinely connected just because you need to make sense, you know, and that's, you know, almost the definition of paranoia.
That's extrapolation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like we saw with, you know, God bless them, what you see with, you know, a lot of the 9/11 theorists who, rather than looking up the history of really what we know happened in terms of who trained whom and when in Afghanistan and the Soviets and all that, instead of looking at any of that, we end up looking at, you know, the picture of that day, the way the plane hit the building, what does that mean, and what was planted and what was there and all, you know what I mean? Whether or not any of the weirdness happened, there was enough regular stuff that happened if you have access to the basic information. You know, there's the published New York Times kind of history since 1980 to 2001. It tells enough of a story that's, you know, condemning enough.
Yeah. One of the other things about this notion of the kind of big data, you know, that was a really intriguing discussion, and I've, you know, been reading a lot about that lately, and particularly the way that, as well as, you know, the fact that Facebook looks like it's for the users, but it's actually a way to, you know, gather data on consumers and to develop these patterns and develop these metrics. That if you follow that line, you're like, what can be done? What can you do about this? Knowing that every day we are involved in that process. And it seemed to be there was an interesting suggestion in your book that part of the thing to move away from was to consider ourselves as and our, especially our online behavior in terms of our individuality, in terms of I'm an individual, this is what I've done, this is the place I've been, these are the things I know, these are my friends, this is the stuff I want, this kind of anxious desire to replicate the old form of the ego inside this new environment in a way sets us up all the better for those kinds of processes. Whereas there's another way of moving into the space, which is to kind of, from the get-go, recognize that you are not the center of the picture and that your networks, and not just social networks in the way that Facebook is, and that's sort of one of the tragedies of the situation, is that if you say social network or you say friend, that now it has this very specific kind of technical meaning when there's something much greater going on. But in any case, moving away from this focus on our own anxiety to reproduce our egos in the digital environment, instead to be paying attention to these cross connections, to the fact that we're always networked with other people, that other people's views of ourselves and our views of other people is partly how we get outside of these kinds of black holes of you know, digital activity and into that wider world of pattern recognition, of multiple interlocking kinds of time, that is precisely through engaging with others, and particularly others who have different perspectives, not in just a simple tolerance way, but really trying to experience and to manifest that larger network. And that seemed to be one of the things that comes through your book, not just in terms of an idea you put forward, but also the way you quote other people, the way that you've done research, the way that you appreciate other people out there who are doing different kinds of work and inspiring you. So just by reading the book, I start to kind of get into not Douglas Rushkoff's perspective, but the way in which you have made yourself a kind of node of a lot of different discourses and ideas, and through that I get to kind of get a larger world. And how is that? I mean, how has that been for you? That kind of moving into away from that egoic focus into this sort of larger ecological way of approaching things.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that honestly has to do with kind of approaching middle age, you know, and my life becoming less about myself than you know, the world I'm in. And, you know, part of that is having been able to resist the isolating and alienating effects of the commercial social media, which is much more about sort of celebrating your individual profile than actually enjoying thinking as a shared activity. And a lot of it is it's kind of learning from people like, you know, Howard Rheingold and Jerry Mikalski and these folks that are, you know, highly networked, you know, the kind of the more whole earth kind of people who ended up becoming digital and valuing their connections more than their own narrative. I mean, what it goes up against, of course, is money, right? How do you earn money in a corporate capitalist you know, society, especially when you're using kind of old personality-driven media like books? You know, it's really interesting. This, I'll be honest with you guys, because we're speaking confidentially here, of course. You know, this book has had, you know, certainly in the 3-4 weeks it's been out, has had way bigger impact than anything I've written, you know, certainly since Media Virus, which was back in like 94, you know, and kind of launched the viral media thing. And this is probably bigger, right? It got a big, you know, New York Times rave from Janet Maslin, and, you know, Wall Street Journal covered me. I mean, who does that? They never cover people like us, and All Things Considered and all these things. But, you know, it's not like it's getting on some super profitable bestseller list, right? This is not competing with Suze Ormond, you know, or Seth Godin or anybody, or, you know, those people who get, you know, they come out on the New York Times, you know, top 10 or something. So And if I did the other thing, I don't know, maybe it would, right? If I was more, this is Rushkoff, he's got the thing, here's the ticket, buy the thing, it'll save your, you know, it'll save your life, it'll save your company, it'll save your marriage, you know, whatever. So it's interesting that way. So on some level, I think it's less it's less commercially viable in the standard industrial age top-down way. But long-term, I would argue, this is the kind of approach that it bodes well for all of our survival in the end. In other words, the approach I'm taking to writing is the same approach that you take to doing community-supported agriculture instead of, you know, Del Monte. It's the approach of a cottage industry as opposed to, you know, some giant top-down extractive thing. You know, the people keep talking about the sharing economy. I mean, the stuff they're sharing is not sharing. You know, sharing a link is not sharing. That's duplicating. You know, sharing a copy is letting someone else use your lawnmower so you don't have to buy seven on the same block, but actually have one. And that's hopefully what's coming. But in order to do that, we've got to step out of the sort of the artificial social reality of the net and use the net instead what it's good for, which is organizing people, you know, and creating authentication. It's not the substitute for our social reality.
Very much so. I think that is a really inspiring sign and you know, a hopeful one. And I think it also reflects the our increasing need to just be honest about the existential challenges. I mean, if not sort of horror sometimes of the moment. And it's like that. It's sort of like the elephant in the room. Like, we all know this is kind of crazy making, and yet there's this drive to kind of keep doing it and keep reproducing it, and the next widget and the next kind of organizing system. I mean, I love that part where you're slagging on the empty inbox people and the obsessive compulsive geek fetish for some kind of solution that itself just actually reproduces the underlying problem. And
right.
I think, like, I hope that we're getting to the end of a certain kind of foolishness about that stuff and can shift the dialogue in another way. But we're going to have to wrap it up here. That feels like we're just beginning, Doug. I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing, though. It's the beginning of our never-ending story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but thanks so much for being on the show.
God, thanks for doing it.
All right, from Majin, meet all you. Keep your minds open.